Call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is Wednesday, June 8th, 2011. We are convened for the purposes of an informational meeting, and I apologize to our guests who will be testifying that we have only two of us here. Evidently, the caucus meetings on both sides have run late. I cut out of mine a little bit early in order to get here. But we do want to respect your time, and Senator George and I will dive into your testimony, and we will be sure that the other legislators, if they aren't here by now, will receive a video copy of your testimony, and it will be considered. So with that being said, I think what I will do is just kind of tee this up. And when we put a lot of work into allowing small business to participate in the state's health insurance rate review process in a meaningful way during NFIB's lobby day, National Federation of Independent Business. I had some subsequent conversations after that with one NFIB member, and he said, you know, this idea sounds fine, but there are other things that we think could also help bring down the cost of health care. And so because of that, I wanted to give NFIB a chance to come contribute to that story about what their point of view on health care and other things that we might do to help bring down costs and bring that to our attention. So with that being said, I'd like to bring up Charlie Tregesser and Michael Wagner, please. And Jan, too, if you'd like. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. And we do thank you sincerely for inviting us to come before you today to address this really critical issue for both our members and I think all small business members, not to mention the individual market. Just to tee our guests up, our two members, Michael Wagner and Charlie Tregesser, there's a statement that I think that we all have consensus on, and that is that our current healthcare system is complex, it's unsustainable, it's somewhat broken, and bears heavily upon the small business segment of our state and our nation. And NFIB has about 7,000 members here in Oregon. We have about 350,000 nationwide. And we were founded in 1943 and have a long history grounded in small business. And our research foundation created a bedrock of information that they've accumulated over many years on small business. And this information is utilized by business leaders and policy makers, not only at the state level, but the federal level as well. And one issue that has stood out during the past and most dramatically in the currently is in the small business landscape is the cost of health care. Our members tell us over and over that this is a very predominant, ever-present, critical, and costly concern to them. And Mr. Tregesser and Mr. Wagner will address specific issues as far as the small business owner and health care costs. But I would like to just bring your attention to, on a more general policy principle basis, and have included today a white paper report produced by NFIB entitled Small Business Principles for Health Care Reform. And we don't have the time here today to go through it. It's 6 pages long. But if you look at the highlighted segments of it, it will bring out some of the goals that we feel are important for small businesses that will bring down costs and that I think would bring about a more sustainable, workable, affordable, accessible health care in our country. So I can refer back to this, but I think for your purposes, what you would like to do is address our small business owners, and I'm open to questions, and other than that, we'll pass the discussion on to them.
Oh, thank you for listening to me. My name is Michael Wagoner. I own a company called Cantel Sweeping. We're located in Gresham, Oregon. And we provide parking lot sweeping services throughout the Portland-Vancouver area. The majority of our customers are property managers that have shopping centers and office parks. Our drivers use vacuum trucks to clean up parking lots. They're working to improve the aesthetics and cleanliness of the places where you and I all shop and work. Plus, they're reducing the level of storm pollutants that go into our runoff stream. Since most of the work is done at night, you probably haven't seen very many of them, but they're out there. I've owned this business for nearly 17 years, and during that time, Cantel Sweeping has grown from a staff of 9 people to a current level of 30 employees. I'm proud that we can provide our employees with livable wage and employee benefits. One of those benefits is, of course, health care insurance. Historically, we've paid 100% of our employees' health insurance premiums. However, the rising costs have forced us to require the employees to begin paying a portion of them. Over the last 9 years, the cost of health care insurance to cover just one employee has increased 126%, from $168 a month to currently it's $380 a month. Just for the record, that's an average of 14% a year. Not just 1 year, not just 2 years. That's 9 years in a row. We've switched carriers. We've accepted higher deductibles, but the costs have grown faster and larger than we can absorb. My family and I are covered through this same insurance policy, so this is not just an employer-employee issue. It's personal. If I can't get insurance for my family, how can I get it for my employees? Every year at renewal time, I'm forced to buy health care for all of my employees. I have a hard enough time deciding what I want for my family, but I'm being asked to decide for all of my employees and all of their families. I believe the employer should actually be taken out of the equation if possible. I'm not asked to buy car insurance for my employees. Why am I being asked to buy health insurance? The solution to rising health care costs and universal access is not something that one employer such as myself can solve. A citizen of Oregon should have access to at least a minimum level of health care, whether they are employed or not. I would advocate a type of universal care where every citizen is entitled to a basic level of health care. Levels of care above that basic level should be available if the patient is willing and wants to pay more. I'd suggest that government limit the number of mandates, and above all, encourage an increase of free choice. Individuals making free choices will mold and drive and create the markets. A fair approach for small business would be for employers, this is my own personal opinion, for employers to pay a tax instead of health care premiums. But this tax should only cover bare bones minimum health care coverage, not a feel-good government-mandated coverage. A private market for additional coverage would quickly develop. I must say, couch this in saying I'm always hesitant to suggest new taxes on businesses. My fear is that government elected officials will forget that businesses never pay taxes. Only individuals really pay taxes. My office manager will write a check payable to the government, but the only way I can have those funds to make that check is to, one, raise prices to my customers, two, hold back salary increases to my employees, or the worst of all situations in today's environment, delay hiring another employee. So I know you've got a tough challenge. I appreciate you listening to me. And if you have any questions, I'll be welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
I think Charlie would take over next.
Chair, Senator Shields, and members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to come in and speak with you today. For the record, my name is Charlie Tregesser, and I'm the owner of Polar Systems Incorporated, located on Willamette Drive in West Lynn. We have 22 employees who help other small businesses manage their technology and their computer networks. We remotely monitor their networks for them. Polar Systems was founded in 1981, and I purchased the company in 1993 following a management career with the IBM Corporation. I'm proud that we can provide our employees with competitive wages and employee benefits. As a business owner, I've made it my priority to provide quality health care insurance as one of those benefits. As a small business owner, I have serious concerns about the disadvantages to which my state government continues to subject the small business community in trying to provide health care insurance to our employees. Now, the premium tax, which resulted from House Bill 2116 from the 2009 legislative session, is a perfect example of this. This 1% premium tax has fallen squarely on the shoulders of small and medium-sized businesses, while exempting those that are self-insured, those are the large businesses, and plans provided through labor trusts. There were other more equitable taxing options available to lawmakers at that time, which could have taxed health care claims across the board, not just premiums for small and medium businesses. Why should big business and the union plans have gotten a pass? In truth, it's because they had the resources to lobby hard to ensure that this tax didn't affect them. Small business can't simply afford the funds or the personal time, like we're taking today, to come and support that kind of a lobby effort. The insurance companies merely passed this 1% premium tax right through to the employers, to the small business employers. Many small businesses like Cantel Sweeping, Michael's company, and Polar Systems made a conscious decision to pass this tax along as a separate payroll deduction to our employees. We educated them as to how the tax came to be, and that the self-insured big businesses and the labor trust plans were exempted from the tax. Shortly thereafter, there was sufficient backlash in Salem, and the state insurance division saw it fit to instruct the insurance companies to cease and desist showing the tax as a line item on our billings. And I'm told that the insurance division even went so far as to direct insurance companies that the tax could no longer even be discussed with the insured by their agents and was to be buried in their billings. Polar Systems has had many opportunities to reduce our employee health care premium costs by participating in nationwide association health care plans, much like the one that NFIB has offered. We continue to be rejected when applying for these plans and are told that they are not permitted by our state insurance commissioner to offer their plan to their members in the state of Oregon. We should not be denied the opportunity to offer these types of premium saving plans to our employees. Instead, we have to resort to joining local statewide association plans through organizations like the Software Association of Oregon, SAO, and we currently are with the United Employers Association. In 2007, legislation was passed requiring that these state association plans maintain a 95% retention rate of their membership. 95% had to stay in their health care plan. Without achieving this said retention rate, they risked being disallowed to even offer the association rate plan rate structure. In 2010, the insurance division's decision to enforce this rule caused considerable consternation to many small businesses and their associated health care plans. Polar Systems was actually put on notice. We received notice that our rates were going to skyrocket in mid-plan year. So we got a rate increase in December, accepted that, and then we were told in March and April that we were going to get another rate, big rate increase, because we had to get off of this association rate and go on to this other small business rate. This caused a very unnecessary drain of our time and resources and was finally resolved by the passage of SB 1003 in the February special session, which created an exemption from the provision. The question is, why were we put through this ringer in the first place? Is this how our state government shows that it supports Oregon's small business? We shop health insurance very hard with my company every year so that we can continue to provide this very important benefit to our valued employees. We optimize our copays and deductibles with our premiums. We change insurance companies if we have to, and often have to change doctors just to control our costs. In spite of all of our efforts, from 2005 to 2009, we experienced a 57% increase. And I'm proud that we kept it to 57%. I mean, we worked hard to do that. And we did that by accepting higher deductibles and copays. And then, from 2009 to date, we've experienced an additional 32% increase in premiums. By now, we've moved to a $1,000 deductible for our employees. As a result, our employees are even now sharing in the cost by paying 20% of the premium. It appears that reoccurring contributors to the increasing problems that small businesses are experiencing in providing affordable health care insurance for employees are ill-conceived and oftentimes unfair government regulations. Small business needs to be able to offer inexpensive health care plans that are not encumbered with unnecessary, extravagant mandates. And we need to be able to use nationwide association health care plans that are currently being disallowed by the state of Oregon. Finally, we need to be protected from our inability to fend for ourselves when having to compete with the lobbying prowess of the big businesses and organized labor. Remember, I came from IBM. I know what big business can do from a lobbying standpoint.
You know who rules the world?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, money talks. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share my view of today's healthcare dilemma from the perspective of a struggling small business owner, and I'm available to take questions at this time if you'd like.
Senator Boquist.
I just want to thank you both for coming. I appreciate it. I own a small business. I'm probably smaller than Senator George over there, but I know exactly what you're talking about, and the time's unfortunately going to come as we continue in a free fall of where, you know, in order to continue to treat employees right, you're going to have fewer employees. Getting bad.
Senator George.
Mr. Jr., I just want to say something that you have nailed it on the head about the political ramifications of what happened last session and what happens in this building, which is you have big government and big business colluding to create policy that basically hurts small business and average taxpayers. And this was a perfect example of what you're talking about. A little different on the question issue, so I had it out there. One of the things, colleagues, I think is really frustrating for a lot of small businesses is that our employees can't go out in the private sector and buy health care and then have it deductible on your taxes. One of the reasons why it ends up being a business responsibility is that we can buy it with pre-tax dollars, where our employees going into the private environment cannot. And I introduced a bill this session that would have tax-advantaged health care plans for individuals in Oregon that would have given them the tax advantage enough that would have been comparable to the advantage that a business gets. So in essence, that an individual whose employer didn't provide health care could go out and buy a plan and then have that tax advantage the same way as if their employer had done it. And I think one of the things we've really done, I think you've hit it directly on the head, is on one hand, you don't dare let your employees not have health care because you have an advantage by buying it through your system. But at the same time, it's become such a huge liability that you can't bear that burden. And our tax structure is built in a way to basically put all the burden on the small businesses. And I think that was a great point also.
One of the things I thought about afterwards is it's actually quite unnerving every year when we get together and say, what are we going to try and get this year? And I'm forced to think about some of my employees and consider things that are not really fair to them. We'll talk about, well, this guy, his wife has a heart condition. I wonder if we switch to another carrier, is she still going to be covered? I have no idea. And so I'm being forced to make decisions that are not just for me and my family, but everybody else with limited or in some cases no knowledge. So, I'm being forced to buy a product that I'm not utilizing.
Mm-hmm. Senator Boquist.
One of the comments that you made that I find interesting, because one of you mentioned that, you know, we really need to get out of the Cadillac of the healthcare and get into the Ford Escort business in order to be economical. And there's a new report out today that you know, at the debt debate in the federal level is arguing out there, is that it now appears 47% of all federal spending this year will be borrowed. And if you didn't see this morning, China is, you know, racing out of two major banks as we speak, saying that they're going to collapse and we're on the verge of another problem. But I have two doctors that actually are involved in, for better word, politics, without going into much detail, here in the Capitol or in the state, and they're saying the same thing, that, you know, we really need to have just basic coverage, and that's the bare minimum level, and focus on that, because we're not going to be able to afford what we think we have now.
One thing that I was hoping to get out of this discussion is where we could go with mandates. Which mandates, and you might not have any off the top of your head, but which mandates going forward, if we're going to put them into a bill form, might we rescind from Oregon statute to be covered? So I don't, if you want to answer now, that's great. If you want to maybe have some discussion about that down the road, we'd be happy to have you come back and kind of try to see if we could craft a bill that would take out some of those unnecessary mandates.
Mm-hmm. Mandates is a very key area of expense, and I would like to carry it on and have a future discussion on it. I know that Oregon has something like 45 or 47 mandates, that placed us in, I think, the 13th position out of 50 states as the most mandates. There were only 12 states that had more than we did. And it's a very complex issue with everything else. It's tough to wager against autism, for instance, which is also one of the most expensive mandates that there is, but I think it's a tough subject that does need to be confronted, and we could do some research on it and bring some more members and how mandates have affected them and their rates.
Yeah, and it would be great to, I mean, because what we're supposed to do here in our best moments is set priorities. That's what the taxpayers send us here to do. And so if we've made some mistakes by mandating certain things and we just can't afford it anymore and you can't afford it anymore, then we should take a very fine-tooth comb to some of those and decide which ones we might want to repeal. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to start by apologizing for not being here for a lot of your testimony. I was called away for a meeting. But I do have your written testimony, and I will definitely read it and study it. And it isn't that I'm not concerned about the issue. I'm a daughter of a small business owner and aware of many of the issues that you're testifying about and talking about. So I want to apologize, but also want to, when we're talking about mandates, I served for, when I was in the House, for a term on the House Healthcare Committee. And it was really interesting, because I remember there was one particular mandate that was being discussed that session that actually would have saved money, because it had to do with, I believe it was oral chemotherapy, and it was actually less expensive, but some of the companies weren't covering it. So I think we have to really look carefully at, when we're looking at the number of mandates, we also have to look at whether the mandate is there designed to save money or if it's actually costing money. And you brought up the autism coverage. I co-sponsored a bill this session that I think is probably going to be find its resting place down in Ways and Means this session, that would require coverage of behavioral treatment for autism. But I understand there's a cost involved. However, when you look at the long-term cost savings, it's very, very significant. Additionally, one of the companies in Oregon has already been under court order to provide similar coverage, and so if one company that's under court order to provide the coverage for the treatment and the other companies aren't, so that was an issue as well. But with, in terms of something like autism behavioral therapy coverage, if you get those kids very, very early into treatment, over the course of their lives, you can save a tremendous amount of money on things like special education plans and everything as they grow. So there's a lot of research showing that early intervention can save money in the long run. So we're also balancing those issues as well. So I really appreciate your being here and the issue, and we'll take a close look at the testimony and look forward to a continued discussion. Thank you.
if I could respond, the one thing I would caution in that, I can't speak too much to specific mandates, but what I would caution is that we in particular small business, do not want to encourage government to set mandates. Let the market set the mandates. The market will mold and create the best, most efficient way to meet those things. And I thoroughly agree. If you can spend some money up front and save a lot more down the road, that's great. But I would caution against government deciding what needs and what does not need to be put in there.
Could I also add to that? I would say that my vision going forward is of an environment where I can't know what mandates are good or bad or should be in there or are great for us for the long haul. But I do know that every time I go to sign up for an insurance policy, I'm going to pick a policy that has things that I think our employees need. And if I pick one that doesn't have a feature or a benefit that the employees are needing, they're going to say, hey, why are you buying this policy? We need this particular feature, you know, something about autism, whatever it might be. And I'll get enough pushback from my employees that I'll be saying to the carriers, this is the policy that I need. And then I'll be able to shop carrier to carrier to find the one that offers that feature at the right price. I can't ever envision being able to be a good judge of the 57 mandates or whatever it was we said are currently in play. I'll never be able to know which of those mandates are really right for us to have in place. But I know that in the free market environment, when I get the chance to start picking a policy that does or doesn't have those mandates, that's when the rubber will meet the road, and I'll know that we're getting the right thing. And those insurance companies, they're going to know what they better put in their policy, and they're going to know what they better price it at. Because if I don't buy it from you, I'll buy it from you.
Okay. And that's
the right price.
That is the beauty of the free market economy, is that with Charlie and millions of other companies making millions of decisions, not only will we make better decisions, we'll also provide information to those insurance companies that will give them feedback. Which policies sell, which ones don't. And if you give them the market enough flexibility to adapt through pricing and choice, it will be a fantastic thing, because it will ebb and flow depending upon where are the cost savings. If they're in autism, you'll see more money flowing that way. It's when you restrict choices that you limit the benefits.
Senator Boquist. Well, I used to think like you gentlemen did in 2005 when I first came here, and now I don't believe the free market works at all. And let me clarify that and go back to what Senator George says. The free market that you're talking about is made up. It has these 57 or so mandates in it. It is made up of the big corporations you just talked about your work, and the rest of us get the crap. Your two companies, my company, Senator George's company, Senator Shields's company, we get the garbage that's left over because of a game of substitution. You talked about the premium tax, how that works very simply, and we're going to pass another bill out here to balance the budget regardless, because it's the best of the worst evils. And what's going to happen is they're going to go right back to the individual insurance and the small business people, and they're going to jack our rates up to subsidize the rates on the other side. The net result that's going to happen for Affordable Act, or whatever you want to call it in the federal government, because it's already out there, is that when you reach the size limit in your sweeping company, you're going to start another company. Your competitors will start another company so they don't meet the size limit, and at some point, you're going to get rid of health care. And it goes back to what Senator George says, two things. What Senator George says is, you know, when you get rid of their health care, they're going to have to go buy it for themselves, and, you know, we're going to play a game in this building about, oh, well, we're going to tax that because it's, you know, tax expenditure versus all this garbage. And the fact of the matter is the individual doesn't, you know, get the tax credit, so they get a poor policy. The thing on getting what's out there in the market is you can't buy what you want, as you pointed out. And the market that we've learned after hearing is so small. You know, and you can beat up the insurance commissioner, which we've done a good job of this committee doing, but it's such a small group that it's the big group, and then they go back to us to fund the bill. And so the free market right now, unless you eliminate all the mandates and do a 180-degree turn, which isn't happening until the thing collapses, which might just be around the corner, isn't going to work. I mean, somehow we've got to figure out how to protect small businesses, because that's 73% of the Oregon economy. So,
I'd like to make a comment first. I'm glad you brought up House Bill 2116, because that was something that I struggled with in the last session on the Budget Committee, and I actually stalled it for a little while because one of the bills that we were talking about in this committee, its predecessor, House Bill 3145, is part of the deal on this. The big insurance company said this bill needs to die in order for this premium tax to go through. And what the bill would have done was to allow small business to elbow its way up to the health insurance rate review process and open those doors, decisions that are mostly now being done behind closed doors with the regulator and the regulated. They said, no, we're only going to participate in this negotiation if you kill this bill that would give small business more say in the rate review process. And that's part of my angst moving forward into this session, is that they've made some overtures on doing that same thing again to spread around some of the money on the premium tax. And I think you're dead on that big business put their, and the unions put their political muscle to bear on this and said, no, we're not going to go along with this. And the whole rationale that I bought into, which I'm starting to question, was that if we insured 80,000 kids, brought them into the health insurance world, you wouldn't have that huge cost shift that's happening. And we also brought in, with that premium tax, the 1% premium tax, 35,000 adults. Well, according to that, right, that logic, health insurance premiums should be going down. But I think what we saw in the last year is just outrageous. And we saw increases at 22, 24, 26%. Who are your carriers?
HealthNet
also.
So you've definitely seen it.
And that's also, that's one thing I was going to mention. Over the 17 years I've been involved in this, I used to have a lot more choices of carriers just over the years. And I can't speak to specific mandates or whatever, but there's fewer and fewer possibilities. So there must be fewer and fewer carriers offering policies.
Yeah. Well, the insurance companies have attempted to throw health insurance rate review and having small business participate in that under the bus again this time. I think that's been resisted. The bill's still in trouble in ways and means, but I do think that these issues are too important to small business to have happen behind closed doors with the insurance division and the regulated. And one of the things that we're working on, and probably have to wait till next session unless we can get some accommodation, is to allow small business to elbow their way up to that table and say, you know, because what I'm hearing is what I think you've said, is that a 26% increase, it just doesn't add up. Nowhere in my business is our prices going up 26%. And so what we worked a lot on is trying to find a way where that small business could elbow their way up to that table, and that's Senate Bill 717. Okay, I've made my pitch. Senator George.
I want to make a similar discussion point, because I think that what we as small business owners are going to have to recognize is this. Right now in the building, we are going to, through our choices, we're going to allocate in essence, a shortage of funding Medicaid, I guess, and we're going to short that, and we're going to say, okay, the providers are going to have to absorb 13%, I think it's the number.
At least.
They're not going to absorb 13%, are they? The hospitals are not going to absorb 13%. So when they go out and they start to distribute that, they're going to distribute that to the small group plans. So what we've done and what we're doing and what we've done through all of these things is that we have basically mandated things. Then we have said that we're going to provide entitlements to people. And then we've buried that in the insurance or in the provider system, which, like a hydraulic, just pops up in the small group plan. And I describe it to the people like this. When I paid my own insurance, I had an HSA, right? I was very frugal when I wrote that check. Now that I'm on the dole and I'm a state legislator and I get gold-plated health care, I go to the doctor all the time because it's free.
It's free, as far as you're concerned.
And the problem that people don't recognize in health care is that we have not engaged the consumer, and the consumer has no connection to the cost. And then we have legislators who think we can give away tons of great free things to people and that those costs are somehow going to be buried in the system. And it's just a hydraulic. And where we're seeing this is, it's all blowing up in the small group plans, which burden small business in the state of Oregon, who are employers. And I think the two of you did an amazing job articulating the frustration of businesses across the state. Thank you very much for coming down and taking time. I really think you made great points.
Thank you. Well, you're always welcome in this committee, and Jan, I appreciate you setting this up, particularly on such short notice.
Thank you for the invitation once more.
Thank you.
Again, thank you for your testimony. All right, could we please bring up now, we're going to shift gears and jump into a different topic that Senator George has brought to us. Could we please bring up John Charles, Asena Squires? How about those two first? And then after that, we'll do Scott Winkles and Olivia Clark. Senator George, do you want to take a few minutes to tee this up?
As you all know, I got this cool new iPad at the beginning of the session. My wife got it for me because she thought I was completely unorganized. Very perceptive. But in doing so, I started downloading these different apps, and I got one of these apps that has to do with, it's called U.S. Debt Plus. And what it did is it started telling me all the, not only the national debt, but also total personal debt in the country. But it had this line that says, basically, U.S. unfunded liabilities at the federal level. And we talk about the national debt being somewhere between $14 and $16 trillion. But between Social Security, the prescription drug liability, prescription drug plan liability, Medicare Part D, Medicare liability, the total U.S. unfunded liabilities right now, things that we have promised people at the federal level, is $114 trillion. That is not in any way, shape, or form sustainable. And I had a conversation with John Charles from Cascade Policy Institute where we were talking about the unfunded liabilities that we all carry on the books. And John pointed out that the state of Oregon allows unfunded liabilities to be carried on the books. And the more we got into it, I asked John if we could put a bill together and to start highlighting this issue so people at least recognize that when we promise something and we don't book it, like you would have to do if you were running a private business, that is a liability that at some point the taxpayers are going to have to fund. And we're either going to break a promise to public employees who believe they have a benefit coming, or we're going to have to raise taxes, or we're going to have to cut other programs. And I think it's really important that we, in our accounting systems in government, at least acknowledge unfunded obligations and actually put them on the books so when decision makers and policy makers are making decisions, those things are obvious to us. So I appreciate Mr. Charles coming and discussing these issues.
John, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, a private nonpartisan nonprofit public policy research organization. And the issue today we're talking about is called Other Post-Employment Benefits, or OPEB for short, and it's a term that most people haven't heard of, including people that I would call political insiders in the building. When I've talked to them in the session, they've never heard of it. But there's a pretty good reason. It's because, first of all, what other post-employment benefits are those things promised by the employer for retirees, for future retirees, other than pensions. So everybody in the building knows what the PERS issue is and the PERS funding crisis. The second wave of the tsunami will be the OPEB unfunded liability. In many ways, it's far worse in terms of its level of funding. Okay, all those other things beyond pensions typically would be health insurance, could be other things. You have over 1,700 units of government in the state, so the things that are promising to employees upon retirement is a long list of possibilities, but it's frequently the health insurance is a big one. Well, up until 2004, employers in the government sector were allowed to sort of bury the cost of future obligations into the system, and they would just have a pay-as-you-go system. And everything they owed down the line was, no one could discern what it was. So GASB, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, decided, they adopted GASB Statement 45, and there's an FAQ sheet, this pink sheet that you have, it's from the GASB website, talks about it, that in 2004 they adopted this rule and it was gradually implemented over a period of years from 2007 to 2009 based on how large the government was. And eventually now all units of government are subject to it, so it's a term that you are going to see more often. In fact, if you ever download the CAFRs, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports for Governments, you'll see now in the notes section, you'll always see statements about unfunded liabilities related to OPEB. The OPEB audits done by the actuary must calculate liabilities for all current and future retirees amortized over a period not to exceed 30 years. And based on those calculations, actuaries determine what the so-called annual required contribution is, or would be, if each entity paid for current OPEB benefits as well as prorated share of future obligations. However, there's kind of a misnomer, and in this blue sheet here, which is our somewhat random examination of 100 units of government out of 1,700, you'll see in the fourth column over the column called annual required contribution. But it's not actually required. On page 2 of this pink sheet, when it has what are the most common misconceptions about statement of 45, I've underlined part that OPEB requires transparency in government. It is finally telling us what are these long-term, in many cases, unfunded actuarial liabilities. However, it does not require governments to fund any of them, just state the liability. So, in some Orwellian turn of phrase here, it says, what's your annual required contribution? It's not required. It is recommended. It is what you would do if you were running your unit of government on an actuarial sound basis so that over a 30-year period, by paying in according to what your actuaries say you should, you will never run into a cash problem going forward. But what has happened, and they indicated on the third bullet point, page 1 of this pink sheet, they indicate that when you pay less now, says you have a problem, the cash flow demands on the government and its tax or ratepayers in future years will be the problem. So what we have seen in Oregon, at least in the 100 that we've looked at, is that overwhelming practice is to pay as little as possible now and dump all of the obligations to future managers or decision makers, and when the whole time bomb explodes, the people doing it now probably won't be around to bear the consequences. To me, this is no different than dealing with teenagers who procrastinate on the term paper. You've heard it all before. Mañana, we'll get around to it, sure. Okay, so out of 100, the bottom line here is that we found about $3 billion of OPEB liabilities, and only 7.8% of them are funded with money in an OPEB trust fund. So when you look at the third column from the right, funded ratio, you see a lot of 0%. That's because they're not putting money in. They're ignoring the ARC. Well, you know, people frequently express concern about PERS, and as of December 31st, PERS was funded at roughly 88% level. That's awesome compared to OPEB, which is 7.8%. And furthermore, the ultimate liability with PERS is fairly well known because it's studied a lot. No one knows what the total unfunded liability is for OPEB because there are more than 1,700 units of government. And aside from the $3 billion on this sheet, there's no comprehensive analysis of what else is out there. And you cannot guess ahead of time by any rational basis where the liability might be. For example, TriMet is number one on this sheet across the board. It doesn't matter what your measure is on the blue sheet. If you're looking at who's got the biggest ARC, who's got the biggest deficit, who's got the biggest unfunded liability, who's got the biggest unfunded liability as a percent of covered payroll, which is the far-hand right column, that's how this is rank ordered. The far-hand right column is top to bottom, biggest to small. Well, TriMet is number one. But if you just look at them analytically, if you didn't know anything, you would say, okay, they're a modest-sized special district. They're not huge compared to other entities. why would this one special district be sitting on about a third of all the unfunded liabilities? See, it's random. You can't know that ahead of time. So we don't know if the $3 billion on this sheet is the tip of a huge iceberg or a small iceberg. So I'm one of, I've learned about this for the last couple of years by reading financial statements. I've learned more about it. I'm not an actuary or an accountant. My public policy response was, well, shouldn't we do something about this? So we, as a matter of respect to future managers, we don't just let this explode. Especially, I'm part of the baby boom generation. A lot of baby boomers are going to be retiring, already are, and these theoretical liabilities are going to become cash flow problems for people managing. And I've, the TriMet board, I've had this conversation many times. They promise over and over they're going to start funding. Of course, they have no money in the fund. Last year, the promise was, well, next year, we'll put $1 million in for sure. Well, the budget they're going to adopt in 2 weeks, oh, about $335,000. You know, promise broken once again. That's what always happens. So I have suggested, and it was embodied in the bill that Senator George introduced, maybe the simplest response, and this is you could consider this in the interim perhaps, would be what I envision as a one-word solution, one-sentence solution. Henceforth, you tell local and governments and special districts, the annual required contribution means annual required contribution, not recommended. Now, keep in mind, there is some precedence for this because at the state level, there is already a version of this in the state statute. ORS 238.420 requires an ARC for the Retirement Health Insurance Account, RHIA, which is a multi-employer OPEB system administered by PERS, which would be number 90 on your blue sheet, page 3. It says the Retirement Health Insurance Account must be funded by employer contributions. Each public employer that is a member of the system shall transmit to the board such amounts as the board determines to be actuarially necessary to fund the liabilities of the account. So, when you look at RHIA, they have a 42% funding ratio, and even though the amount of money that they owe as a unfunded liability is $297 million, seems like a large amount, it represents only 3.5% of the covered payroll. So by that perspective, it's a modest risk because they're always forced to pay in each year. So state government, you know, the ones on the blue list that have substantial amounts of money in a trust fund are typically state units. It's the local and special districts that are choosing to defer all this. So I guess in conclusion, I'd say there's probably an infinite number of responses you could take. Anyone reading this blue sheet, it's a very data-rich sheet, and you can come to your own conclusions. And there's all kinds of possible solutions, but I believe the simplest approach would be to say, well, you hire actuaries anyway. They're doing audits. We trust them to be impartial arbiters of this. Why don't we call them the referees of the game? And when they say, here's what your ARC is, then you must put that money in the trust fund so that your employees now who think there's something down the road for them are not going to wind up with essentially a bankrupt government and those promises don't get kept. And if you can't meet the ARC, which is essentially like saying you bought a house and you can't even pay the first mortgage payment, well then you've made a mistake. Deal with it now. Don't keep not paying the ARC and then hope that 10 years later the Easter Bunny will show up. You're just deluding yourself and your employees and the public, because ultimately, if things go under, the public's going to be on the hook in some way. So I think that'd be a great issue for you to take up in the interim, because obviously this is complex. No one's going to act, you know, just right now. But if you had affected parties, you brought them to the table, you talked about it. I think this is a national problem. The OPEB debt situation is at a national level, just hundreds of billions of dollars. I think it would behoove Oregon to be a leader here in proactively beginning to get a handle on this.
Okay, great. Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Senator Brown Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, you said there was a statute that applies to state entities, and you said what that was, but I missed the citation.
Senator Brown Meacham, it's ORS 238.420.
Thank you.
Senator George.
So John, I know in our conversations about this bill that you had mentioned that you were going to talk to a few of the public employee unions who ultimately most likely will be the ones whose members pay probably the most dearly on this. Any conversation with the public employee unions about their view of the fact that their employers are making promises that they're not funding?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I haven't had a comprehensive conversation with public employee unions generally, only at TriMet, which is an entity I've focused on a lot because they have so much debt. And they have been, actually, when I've testified at TriMet board meetings, they've been extremely supportive. And I wouldn't say public employee unions generally are all warm and fuzzy with what we do at Cascade. But on this issue, they have been totally supportive, understanding that it's great to have, they pay over $2,000 per month per employee for health care for current and retired folks and dependents. So they're way beyond gold-plated. Well, okay, that's great to say that that's going to happen, but what if the entity runs out of money? And that entity has cut service four times in the last 2 years. They are running out of money. Governments can go bankrupt. So I keep saying to them, you can't keep procrastinating. You owe $75 million a year and you're paying $14 million. That's not going to get it done.
Okay. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
How about, should we bring up all three? Scott Winkles and Olivia Clark, please.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles, and I am representing the League of Oregon Cities today, and I will open with a brief confession. I was somewhat reticent to agree to be invited to testimony today because I believe that implies a certain level of elevated expertise, but since Mr. Brennan had already published the calendar with my name on it,
you're welcome.
I will go forward, and the reason I say I don't think I have the elevated expertise is that I don't quite understand precisely what Senate Bill 985 would do and which liabilities it would be subject to. And as Mr. Charles indicated in his testimony, this is a very complicated issue. 985 is written would require this a trust fund be established, and we pay into that trust fund to cover liabilities, with the exception of those liabilities that are mandated by state statute. But it also speaks to an implicit subsidy for a benefit, and therein lies the conflict. And I would call the committee's attention to ORS 243303. What that statute does is it requires the local government to offer health care insurance to their retired employees, and prohibits them from putting them into a separate risk pool. So you have retirees who are 2.5 times more expensive to insure than your active employees, at least for now, but you're not allowed to risk rate them, so essentially you blend the premium between your retirees and your current employees. Again, we are required to do this by statute, and that's what's generating that liability, because the total cost, the total premium for that employee, for the retiree or for the active, has to be the same. So if arbitrary number, so if the entire premium is, say, $750 for an employee, whether it's employer or employee share, that total premium, that's how much you have to sell that insurance for to your retired employees. That's what generates a significant portion of the liability that I believe is on Mr. Charles' sheet. There are some other liabilities. For instance, the city of Corvallis, they have it's a small dollar amount, some subsidized life insurance for retirees prior to 65. Very small dollar amount. I don't know why you'd want to trust fund something that small. But again, most of this liability is the result of a state statute. It is not something that cities and most local governments have wanted to do. It's complicating the issue is that if your employees choose to organize under the banner of a union who has their own health insurance policy or program, and part of being a member is being a member of that, is being a subscriber to that plan. The employer would negotiate those benefits, but the typically the labor plans don't allow retirees into the active pool. So they may have a separate pool. It's probably a lower coverage. It's probably something like an 80-20 plan. But they don't allow the retirees into the pool for the same reason that we don't want to allow retirees in the pool, is because it's not a financially sound practice. However, the statute is what the statute is, and we don't think complying with a statute is a bargainable topic. So we run into conflicts with some of our friends across the bargaining table when we deal with the statute. And I would call your attention to the Medford case, where Medford said it was not practicable for them to provide the coverage. The court did not concur with their assessment, and they went to the Supreme Court, and they're now under a court order to buy their insurance from a plan that will allow the retirees into the pool. So I think, again, this is a complicated issue. I think we should decide what liabilities are necessary, whether or not these liabilities are sound public policy, whether they're financially sustainable, and then take a look at how we're going to fund them. So the league would certainly support a significant change to 243303 that would address the liability and remove some of it, as opposed to trusting it. With that, we'll turn it over to my colleague or take questions.
Okay. Olivia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet here today. And like Scott, I have to tell you, I'm not a CPA. I'm not a CFO. But I'm happy to bring back information if there are questions that I can't answer about TriMet's situation regarding Senate Bill 985. And I wish that our CFO were here today. But this bill, let me just say that TriMet's board, we have four new members on our board, we have a new general manager, we have a new CFO, they're all very, very aware of this issue, very aware. And TriMet's very transparent. This issue is in all of our financial statements, very well aware of it. And our new board and new management has adopted a policy to bring total employee compensation, including wages and health care benefits, in line with a sustainable financial forecast. So they're very committed to that. We're also, I don't think Scott mentioned GASB, but I think John Charles did, we're in full compliance with the GASB requirements. We have a pay-as-you-go benefit. And we have, for the first time, set aside in this coming fiscal year, set aside our first contribution to a reserve account to begin to address this issue. And we would have done it sooner. We would have had a larger payment, but we're coming out of the worst recession since the 1930s. So our contribution this year is somewhere under $500,000. But it's a start, and they're committed to it. I think for TriMet, and I'm sorry that Senator Boquist left because he said something I thought was pretty interesting about moving from a Cadillac benefit to, I can't remember what he said, a Ford Escort or whatever it was. But I think that that's something that TriMet is wrestling with, is we have a Cadillac healthcare benefit for current employees as well as retirees. That's developed over 30 years. It's going to take a few years of negotiations with our union to scale that back to something that's more sustainable. And you may have heard that we're in a protracted negotiations right now. We're hoping to go into arbitration. We would love it sooner, but it doesn't look like we can do that until January, and that's a major issue for us, is those health care benefits. They've been going up by double digits in the last 10 years. That's part of the problem that you see here. An actuarial analysis of our best offer, and I don't want to get into the negotiations necessarily, but just to give you a sense of perspective, an actuarial analysis of our best offer to our union would cut our unfunded liability by over 30%. And that's the route that we're taking to address this, in addition to complying with GASB and setting up a reserve account. I would just add for the record also that our auditors, we actually met with auditors this morning, our finance committee. We talked about this, as a matter of fact. And everything is in the open. They do not recommend setting aside the full ARC, as it's called. They don't recommend bonding for it. If this bill, as we understand it, were to be implemented as it is, we would be in the position of cutting service in order to fund it. Because I think on John's sheet it shows about a $75 million ARC per year to reach the full amount. We're paying $14 million a year now for the pay-as-you-go. That means $60 million would have to go into an account, sit there. That means probably a 20% cut in TriVet service. I'm just estimating. I think we're going to try other creative approaches to getting at our health care benefits like other employers, whether it's plan design, and I know from the earlier witnesses that was a real issue. Our plan design is an issue for us. Maybe a case management approach. We're looking at everything we can do to get those costs down and to work with our employees to deal with utilization rates as well. We're going to be paying close attention to the state negotiations as well with state employees. I think that's going to have some influence on what happens to TriMet. But with that, I try to answer any questions I can about this. But that's basically our situation. We're well aware of it, and we're working on it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Further questions? Senator George.
I really appreciate you both coming, and I know you're not the experts on this, but I think that what we're facing with PERS liability, and as you all know, I got a briefing from one of my local special districts, or actually school districts, about what they're projecting over the next 5 years their PERS liability will be as a percentage of payroll. And as we're, and when you look at like Medicaid, Medicare, and you look at the unfunded liability, we're really headed towards a really, really, really big problem by having all these unfunded liabilities hanging out there. This is just one of them. And the question for special districts, too, and I'll talk to Hussein outside, but could we put something together between now and February to try to address this issue, and Olivia, to give you guys some maybe some additional tools and flexibility to try to address this? Because with our local governments carrying debt or unfunded liabilities of $3 or $4 billion is a should be a big problem for us as a legislators, because at the end of the day, if you all fail, we end up holding the bag. I mean, the state policymakers are going to have to carry the hold the bag on this. Is there any effort by your leaderships to work with the legislature on trying to deal with this on a statewide basis?
Senator Shields, co-chair, vice chair, Senator George. Yes, when the companion to the House companion of this bill was heard in the House Rules Committee, my testimony was similar to what it was today, but we had suggested and been attempting to get out of that committee an amendment to that bill that would gut and stuff it as a study bill to come back with recommendations to address particularly that the 243-303, but the other liabilities as well. Because, again, I think the first question we should ask is, what can we do to reduce the liability? Because from the league perspective, this is not a liability we should have ever incurred, and it wasn't our idea to incur it. I don't know who the HR lobbyist for the league was when this was passed, but I can't imagine that they got behind this. I made a concerted effort and spent a tremendous amount of staff time attempting to get that bill out of the House. I don't think that's going to happen, but that was my effort.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I would just agree with Scott. Just to clarify, too, the term is not in PERS.
So it's a different. Broadly, we have this issue. We as a state have this issue.
But part of our issue is self-imposed. But I think we'd be very interested in what Scott was proposing.
All right, good. Well, we appreciate you coming to testify. And Senator George, thanks for bringing this to our attention. We look forward to working with it perhaps in the interim or in the next, in February or the next session. So, really need to close anything, but I will. And now that Senator Esquivel is here, I thought I would tee up our next discussion regarding his bill, House Bill 3389. We were in his office having a big discussion on very big ideas to
see what we could do to bring down the cost of health care for small business. And Representative Esquerel was lamenting that a bill that he had didn't receive a vetting this session. So I say, well, we anticipated having a public hearing on health insurance premiums related to small business, and we'd love to hear from him and his idea and anybody else he would like to have testify on it. So with that being said, Representative Esquivel, welcome to the committee. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. We look at things maybe not in the right light. And what I mean by that is that we talk the talk when it comes to lowering of health care and have accessibility of health care to people, yet we don't seem to lift a finger to make sure that that is taken care of, where their health care costs could be lower. Your premium that we pay now, the bill that I had would have allowed people to go across state lines and get with 700 other insurance companies to bid. But more importantly, you wouldn't have to have had the state mandates. I found that I, as well as other people, are responsible for these mandates. We voted them in, and we think, oh, it's only a half a percent, or it's only a percent. The unfortunate thing is we have a little over 50 mandates in the state of Oregon, which means, in reality, your premium of what you want is a basic premium and coverage. Catastrophic, usually, is what we're talking about. What we've done to the people of the state of Oregon, and I am as guilty as anyone, is piled on mandates to the point of where it's costing each and every individual in the state of Oregon 35% to 50% more on their premium for the same basic coverage they could receive for almost half that price if they went across state lines. That's one alternative, and it should be a cafeteria style. Example, if you want to have maternity benefits, you should pull that out and you should pay for it. If you want prosthesis, if you want optic order, whatever you want, you pull that out in a cafeteria style. That gives the end user not only an advantage when it comes monetarily to receiving a coverage, but it also opens up access for many more people. Instead, we have the mentality that we as government have to provide this for people at the expense of the taxpayer. And that's exactly what we're doing today. And what we do is we force a Cadillac premium on people. Well, maybe they don't want a Cadillac premium. Maybe they don't want to pay for hearing aids. Maybe they don't want to pay for maternity benefits. Maybe they want to pay for what affects just them. And with this alternative that I had, we would have allowed that to happen. You would have received the same basic coverage you do on your premium today on catastrophic injury, but it would have been approximately 40-50% less in money. So, example, if you're paying $1,000 for the same basic coverage, you'd be paying $500 to $600 by going across state lines without mandates. But the real problem is, I feel, we don't look in the proper venue on why it costs so much. Why is hospitals outstripping inflation 2, 3, and 4-fold? Why is the cost of a hospital so high? Is it because, and I've been told all along, it's people without premiums, without any coverage. So therefore, the cost rises for the rest of us. When I grew up in Medford, we had a county clinic. I'm not sure that that isn't such a bad idea to look back into that with the money we were spending as a state, but the money we're spending as taxpayers. And whether it be federal money or whether it be state money, it's still our money. It's still taxpayer money. If we had across the street from each hospital a 24/7 clinic that you went into the emergency room if your arm was pulled off or something, I understand that. But if you went in there with the sniffles, you were immediately sent to the clinic across the street, it would drop that cost of that hospital immensely.
Where's the money in that, though?
Pardon?
Where's the money in that?
Yeah, there you go. Well, what are you doing? What are you talking about?
Your point's very, very well taken, Representative Epskill. You don't mind me jumping in, and, because I'm looking at in North Portland, there's not an urgent care anywhere near our house, and so we have to go to Beaverton in order to get to urgent care. And none of the hospitals, best I can tell, are operating any urgent cares. And I think
it's something that needs to be fit into our society today because it's needed. I had a little youngster; one of our grandsons fell down, broke his head open on a fireplace, and walked around an emergency room for 5.5 hours before he was attended to with his head split open. And he was 2.5, and they finally got to him. He was in there 10 minutes, and it was a $1,200 bill for 4 stitches. Somehow that doesn't balance.
Doesn't add up.
No. So we are not looking into the real problem. We are not looking into why it costs. I mean, when was the last time we went and evaluated what hospitals are actually doing and why their cost is so outstripping inflation 3 and 4 to 1? We just don't have the answers, and I think we need to have the answers. But more importantly, I still think we have to have the ability to be able to go across state lines without state mandates and purchase our basic coverage so we can cover more people that's affordable to people.
Thank you. One of the things that we found in this committee is that certainly over the last year, medical inflation is considerably lower than it has been, yet premiums are still going up through the roof, and medical utilization, the amount of times that people actually go to the doctor, is at the lowest point that it's been in decades as well. And I think a lot of it is because of what you're talking about. If people can't afford the copays and their deductible is $2,500, and they're not going to the doctor as much, and they're getting...
Well, I think people should be able to go to their primary care physician on issues, but they shouldn't be going to the emergency room when they should be going to their primary care facility. And that's what we need to turn about for the hospital's sake themselves. I think that we've kind of got the system to where we have funneled through, I don't know how we've done it, but we've funneled into the emergency room everything. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
We have to get away from that emergency room.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Esquivel. It's a very interesting discussion and really complex. And I agree that there should be more sort of primary care clinics or urgent care clinics instead of emergency rooms. In fact, I think Good Sam has an urgent care clinic right there, so it's an alternative to people who think they need to go to the emergency room. But you raised a really intriguing idea about the cafeteria style insurance, and I don't know if anybody does that or anything close to that, because the complexity, I think, is because there's so much unpredictability, and the whole purpose of insurance is to sort of spread the loss and to shift the risk to the insurance company. But with the unpredictability, like, I don't know what's going to happen to me or my family, and so I don't know if I should buy, you know, cancer insurance or osteoporosis insurance or prosthetic insurance, because I don't know what's going to happen to me. And so you'd have to have a system, there'd have to be a change in the system so that certainly you couldn't have a pre-existing condition problem, because if I wanted to buy insurance for something that I can't predict, how do I know what to buy is the concern.
Like, I can see it because my Senator Bonamici, I think that depends upon the individual and your age. You will be able to figure it out. I know that if I'm 62 years old, 63 years old, I certainly don't need maternity benefits. That I do know. I may need cancer.
I'm with you on that one.
I may need cancer, but I do not need that particular part. But when I'm 20 years old and getting married, I probably be looking very closely at that benefit.
I think, Mr. Chair and Representative, that it may be easier to figure out what we don't need than what we do need. So I don't know how you get to the place that you know what insurance coverage to that you do need, but it's intriguing.
Before you go, Sal, can you explain the mechanics of the interstate compact idea for health insurance? That's the heart of the bill, right? Mm-hmm. And there, if I recall, Arizona has passed a bill, and there would need to be a number of states that where you would reach a critical mass before something like this could go into effect.
You could. You have to marry up with one other state.
Okay.
And that's to make sure that you don't have to adhere to the mandates. We would like marry up with Nevada or Arizona or someone of that nature, which in turn they have their own, you know, insurance commission, so it is legitimate within that state. I don't feel that Oregon would be at any worse jeopardy than it is today. I think, and you and I agree 100%, that this whole process of these premium rates need to be brought out in the sunshine, and we need to make a public record of it. I agree with that 100%, and you and I have sat down and discussed that. How come everything keeps continually going up? I hear in this building, well, we're doing this and we're doing that, and it's going to save this and it's going to save that. Yet I have yet to speak with anyone in the last 10 years that their insurance premium has gone down.
I'm interested.
I mean, what obviously what we're doing isn't correct.
That's right. No, I think that's right. And what's been the response of the insurance companies to your proposal?
Didn't get a hearing, so therefore got, received no response. I would think, you know, I don't know. I can't speak for them, but just looking at it, six of one, half done the other, it's going to be less money on maybe a percent of a premium because the premium would be higher on a percentage basis. But, you know, when you have a basic coverage and you're competing with 700 other insurance companies, you should be able to get a pretty good rate.
If I was a betting man, I'd say the local insurance companies don't like your idea.
Probably. You know, I've talked to some in my area that the agents, they, six one half done the other. They get their percentage on what they sell.
Either way, right.
Yeah.
Good. All right. Well, thank you very much for bringing this idea forward.
Thank you, Senator.
Maybe we can give it a try in the future sessions. And I appreciate you sticking with me, Senator Bonamici, and this meeting is adjourned.